Hello and welcome to Lectionary at Lunch at Concordia Seminary. I'm Professor Tom Egger, and today we'll be looking at the pericope from Isaiah chapter 5, verses 1 through 7, appointed for the 16th Sunday after Pentecost, proper 21, I believe. And the gospel reading that is paired with this Old Testament reading is the parable of the wicked tenants from Matthew 21. Both have to do with a vineyard. Our Isaiah text is this famous Song of the Vineyard, where Isaiah speaks God's word toward the people of Judah and really calls on them as witnesses against themselves. The book of Isaiah up to this point, the prophecy of Isaiah, has been full of judgment oracles against the people already, against Judah and Jerusalem. It's begun already in chapter 1 by calling heaven and earth to witness against them. And it's talked about how desolate already the land has become because of their sin and the coming judgment of God. And the prophecies look at the current situation in Judah and Jerusalem, proclaiming that God's judgment is already underway, but they also, especially here in chapter 5 and looking ahead up through chapter 11, speak of the judgment that is still coming and that is hanging over and about to be unleashed on Judah and Jerusalem because of their sin. Let's just jump into the Hebrew text, and then we can make a few comments about the theology as and the rhetoric as we move along. Verse 1 begins, Ashirah na li didi, shirat dodi lekarmo. Kerem Hayah Lididi Bekeren Ben Shaman. So the prophet begins here with this first-person voice. The first verb from the Halarut Shir is a cohortative, a call cohortative. Let me sing. May I sing. Lididi. Yedidi is one word for beloved. Another word for beloved is Dod in the next clause. And the Lamed here is probably just a dative of advantage. I'm singing for my beloved. Let me sing for my beloved a shirat dodi, a song or the song of my beloved. Shirat in construct there with dodi. The song of my beloved, le karmo. Kerem, which you see in its absolute form in the next line, means vineyard. And so the lamed here is a lamed that simply addresses the topic about which he's singing. Let me sing the song of my beloved about his vineyard, with reference to his vineyard. The second line of verse 1 then, Kerem Hayah Lididi, a vineyard was belonging to my beloved. This is a standard Hebrew expression of possession. With Hayah plus la, there was a vineyard belonging to my beloved. In English, we would say, my beloved had a vineyard. And the last phrase there, Bekeren ben Shaman. This is an interesting expression. It very literally says, on a horn of a son of fat, or on a horn of a son of oil. Presumably here, Keren, horn, refers somehow to the landscape and probably has the sense of an outcropping or section that sticks out from the rest of the land, like a horn, on a horn of a son of fat. And this expression, ben in Hebrew, oftentimes is used in different combinations to refer to the nature of something, such as a son of wickedness is a wicked person, or a son of 500 years is a 500-year-old person. Here, a son of fat refers to the essential nature of the Karen, this outcropping of land. And fat here, not in the sense that it was somehow covered with grease or something. Shemen can mean fat or oil or grease. But rather, fat in the sense of the choicest part, the richest, most luxurious part of the land. The point, then, is that the land that's selected here by the vineyard owner, by the singer's beloved, is the best land possible. He had this vineyard, and it was on an outcropping of the choicest land, a horn of a son of fat. Verse 2 now, we've had kind of the situation laid before us here. The beloved has this vineyard, and now a series of actions take place. It's implied that he's chosen, selected for the vineyard, the best possible place. And now we have this series of vav consecutive imperfect verb actions here. Vayazakehu, vayasaklehu, vayitaehu sorek, vayivin migdal batoko, vagam yekev chatsev bo, vaykav leasot anavim, vayaas ba'ushim. All right, these initial actions, these vav consecutive verbs, the first one is a PL, vav consecutive imperfect. Notice the ehu suffix on the end, third masculine singular object suffix. Azak means, it's not a common word, it means to dig around. And in the PL, you can probably see that suggestion of PL action as repetitive. So he dug around it, it referring to the vineyard. And the next verb, sakal, sakal in the call conjugation can mean to stone something or someone. In the PL, it has the sense here in this context of remove stones from. So he removed stones or its stones. He removed stones for it, ehu, at the end, again referring to the vineyard. He dug around it. He cleared it of stones. And he planted it, the third verb here, a call verb from nata, to plant. He planted it. And then we have an adverbial accusative there suggesting the material with which he planted it. He planted it with sorek, choice vine. This root sarak has to do oftentimes with the color red. And so probably the background here is this is a particular kind of grape or a particular kind of vine stock which was known for producing rich red grapes. So the vineyard owner, the beloved, has chosen the choicest land. He's dug all around the vineyard, cleared it of stones, planted it with choicest vine. And the next line verse 2, he built, vayivin from bana, he built a migdal, a tower or a watchtower, batoko, in its midst. Now, towers had to be built in vineyards because a vineyard outside of the towns was always susceptible to theft or raiding or destruction. And so, especially when the grapes were getting ripe, sometimes the vineyard owners, or at least one of their servants, would stay out in the watchtower and keep an eye on things. So the vineyard owner is taking no risks here. He builds a migdal in its midst. And finally, vagam yekev katsev bo. And also, gam, the little adverb also, a wine press or a wine vat he hewed. The call perfect verb katsev here, to hew something out of rock. He did this in it, bo, in the vineyard. Now, it's interesting. We've had all these vav consecutive imperfect verbs. He did this, and he did this, and he did this. And now we have this disjunctive vav before gam. It breaks the flow of things, and it puts an emphasis on this last phrase. And the adverb gam also places an extra emphasis. And he even hewed out a wine press in it. And that last action looks forward to the next line. It shows that he's not just taking actions that have to do with the front end, the preparation and the planting of the vineyard, but he is taking actions that are full of great expectancy. What could be more expectant than the labor of hewing out of solid rock a large dish-shaped area in which to crush the grapes once they are ripe, or to store the grape juice once it is ripe, a wine press or a wine vat. So you have these actions. He dug around it, cleared it of stones, he planted it with the choicest vine, and he built a tower in its midst, and he even hewed out of rock a wine press in it. And last line of verse 2, he waited, from the PL verb kava, he waited And then you have le asot. This is the infinitive construct of asa. The lamed on the front indicates what he was waiting for. He waited for making an avim. And the implied subject of the infinitive here is the vineyard itself. He waited for the vineyard producing an avim, grapes. And then this last short phrase of the verse, vayas, and it produced. And now this one word stands in contrast with everything that's gone before. And he waited for it to produce grapes, and it produced, vayas, ba'ushim, sour grapes, bad grapes. All of the preparation that's taken place here leads to the expectation that this last noun here will be a pleasant noun, ripe grapes, sweet grapes, fine wine. But instead, what does it actually produce? Ba'ushim. Sour, rotten grapes. And now verse 3, v'ata, and now. Ata is often a strong rhetorical word in Hebrew. It signals that something's been discussed, and now, here's the significance of it. V'ata, and now, yoshev Yerushalayim, v'ish Yehuda. These are vocatives here, and the speaker is addressing here the yoshev Yerushalayim, the inhabitant of Jerusalem. And the man of Judah. O inhabitant of Jerusalem and O man of Judah, and now we get an imperative. Shiftuna beini uvein karmi. Judge, if you will, na, judge please, beini, between me, uvein karmi, and between my vineyard. Notice what's happened to the voice here in Isaiah's song. Isaiah began singing about this third person, his beloved, and this beloved's vineyard. And he speaks about the vineyard owner doing all these things in the third person voice throughout verse 2. But suddenly in verse 3, the vineyard owner himself, Isaiah's beloved himself, begins to speak in the first person, judge between me and between my vineyard. Again, this kind of courtroom language, judge between, declare who's in the right and who's in the wrong. This really echoes in some ways the language at the beginning of Isaiah, where God through Isaiah is calling heaven and earth to witness against his own people for the way that they have forgotten their God and their owner. Verse 4, Ma la asot od le karmi velo asiti bo. What to do, again, the call infinitive construct of asa, what to do owed further for the benefit of my vineyard, le carmi, velo, and not I did it in it. So the sense here is, what more could I have done? Here the implied subject of le asot, the infinitive, is the first person now, the speaker, I. What to do yet, what more, in other words, could I have done for the sake of my vineyard? And then asiti here, just the call perfect, first person common singular of asa, and I did it, or I didn't do it, bo in it. It's interesting, the prepositions here, it's not a, I don't think, greatly significant, but first he says, what more could I have done for my vineyard? And I didn't do in it, bo. And I think that in it harkens back to the language of verse 2, where the vineyard owner is pictured doing all of these actions, digging around, removing stones, planting choice vine, building a tower, and even hewing out a wine vat. And the last word of that series is bo in it. The second line of verse 4 then really comes to the crux of this passage. And this is God's question here. First, he's already asked a key question. What more could he have done? But really, this is the great question. Madua kiveti la'asot anavim v'ya'as ba'ushim. Now, this repeats some of the language from the end of verse 2. But the question here is, Madua, why? Why did I wait, the PL perfect from kava, a third hey root, to wait or expect. Why did I expect? Why did I wait for producing grapes, for it to produce grapes, and it produced sour grapes? This is the great, theologically, this is the great mystery, not only of this passage, but of human sinfulness. How can it be that God has created all things perfect and good, and yet somehow his people have turned against him and produced not anavim, good grapes, good fruit, but evil fruit, bad fruit, sour grapes? The question is pertinent not only to Adam and Eve in paradise at the beginning, but also to Israel herself. Israel herself, though, yes, she was a stiff-necked people and she was a descendant of sinful Adam and sinful Eve and ultimately sinful Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, still, God had redeemed her from her slavery. He had given her holy laws. He had forgiven her sin. He had planted her. This idea of a vineyard is pregnant with reference to Israel's own history. God had taken Israel out of Egypt and planted her in the land like a vineyard. And he had done such great things for Israel, treated her so richly, recreated her, you might say, recreated humanity as a new people through Abram's line, through this people that he brought into the promised land and planted him there. They were without excuse for producing the fruits of mishpat and tzedakah, justice and righteousness that God desired. So why was it that they produced only bad? And we could ask the same question of ourselves after all that God has done for us in Christ, rescuing us, claiming us as his own, bringing us through the waters of the sea in our baptism, giving us his holy will and his good laws to live by, giving us a new name, a fresh start, recreating us, giving us his spirit, all of these things he has done for us, and yet so often he looks for us, waits for us to produce grapes, and we produce sour grapes. Verse 5, V'ata, there it is again. He's made the case, and now another turning point in the rhetoric. And now, here's what will come because of God's indictment against the people. V'ata odia na etkem et asher ani oseh lekarmi. And now I will make known to you. Here we have the hithil, first person imperfect. Actually, it's a cohortative there with that extra comets hey on the end of odia. Let me make known, or let me cause to know, direct object, you all, et kem. So let me cause you all to know, let me make known to you. And then the next phrase, et asher, direct object, that which, here asher is basically a substantive particle, that which ani ose. Ani is the pronoun I, and ose, the participle, am doing. And oftentimes the participle bears the sense of imminent action. And so here probably a good way to translate this would be, let me make known to you that which I am about to do, that which I am about to do with respect to my vineyard, le carmi. What God's about to do is expressed chiefly in the rest of the verse here with two infinitive absolutes. First, the hithil infinitive absolute, haser, which comes from the verb sur, to turn aside, but in the hithil has the sense of remove. And it's the infinitive absolute, so there is no person or number or gender or tense or anything here. It simply has to be dictated by the context. And here God has just said what he is about to do. So it's proper to render these then as first-person verbs. I will remove, or I am about to remove, musukato, its hedge, it referring back to the vineyard, v'haya leva'er, and it will be, the vineyard will be, for the purpose of burning, a PL infinitive construct there from Ba'ar to burn up, and it will be for burning up. And then another infinitive absolute here. Here, the call infinitive absolute of Paratz to tear down. I will tear down its garade, its wall, v'haya l'mirmas, and it will be for trampling. Mirmas is a verbal noun. It means trampling. It comes from the root ramas, which means to trample. And this first verb of the last phrase there, paratz. Paratz, to tear down, is a fairly standard verb, I suppose you could say. It just means to tear something down. But it is interesting in its usage in the Old Testament that it is so often used particularly in two contexts. One is the tearing down of the wall of a city, especially with reference to the walls of Jerusalem, when the Babylonians finally come and destroy the city. And secondly, it's used oftentimes with commands to destroy altars and pagan architecture and furniture, such as standing stones or Asherah poles. Even though it just is talking about a vineyard here, tearing down the wall that would be around a vineyard to protect it, it still rings with this language of tearing down pagan shrines in the Old Testament, I think. And ultimately, it comes to its fruition, its fulfillment in Old Testament history with the Babylonian conquest, where Jerusalem is literally destroyed and its walls paratzed, torn down. Verse 6, V'ashitehu bata lo yizamer v'lo ye'ader v'ala shamir v'ashayet v'al ha'avim utzaveh me hamtir alav matar. Begins with what looks like at first a vav consecutive imperfect with that vav patak, but the patak is there under the vav actually because of the compound schwa under the aleph there at the beginning of verse 6. And so the value of the patak under the vav is really just a schwa. So here it's not a vav consecutive imperfect, but rather it is a simple vav plus a first-person imperfect verb. God's continuing to express what he will do. He doesn't use another infinitive absolute here, but he actually uses this finite verb form. It's the imperfect of the verb sheet, which can mean to set or appoint. And here, with this ehu ending, and I will appoint it or set it, bata, destruction or desolation or emptiness. And here, sheet with an object like batar, the sense is God will make it this. God will make the vineyard waste. He will lay it waste, I suppose we would say in English. Now the verbs shift from God's own actions to what will be the case for the vineyard itself. We have two passive verbs now, two nifal verbs. It will not be pruned, zamar, and it will not be hoed or weeded. This is a rare verb, adar, but in the passive here it has a sense of it won't be hoed or weeded. So it will no longer be cared for, this vineyard. And so what will result? V'ala shamir v'shayet. And it will go up thorn and thistle, or thorns and briars. These two terms are rendered in different ways. These are the subject of the verb Allah. This is what will go up, thorns and briars. And this word pair always occurs as a pair, and it's very common in the book of Isaiah, especially in chapters 5 through 9. God has declared this sentence on the vineyard, that it'll be overtaken by thorns and briars, and now even once we leave the image of the vineyard behind, as we go into chapters 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 in Isaiah, this idea of thorns and thistles will continue to come up again and again as God's sentence on the people of Israel. And finally, he makes this amazing statement, the last part of verse 6, and concerning va'al, the clouds, he-avim. You have that unusual segol with the definite article on avim there because of the unaccented comets under an ayin on the front. But it's just a regular definite article, the clouds. And concerning the clouds, I will tsava, I will command. And then you have a hithiel infinitive construct with a preposition min on the front. God will command concerning the clouds from the act of raining, from raining upon it rain. Matar there at the end, rain, is a cognate accusative. It's the verb, the hithiel verb matar, takes the direct object matar. In other words, its direct object comes from the same root. He will command concerning the clouds from raining upon it rain. In other words, he will command the clouds not to rain upon it, and it again being the vineyard. Verse 7 then is the climax. Ki kerem Yahweh Tzevaot Beit Yisrael, for the vineyard of Yahweh of hosts, and then you make this first line into a verbless sentence, is the house of Israel. As if all this weren't obvious already. Perhaps it wasn't, but likely the hearer has seen where this is going, but this makes it very explicit. This vineyard that Isaiah is talking about is the vineyard of Yahweh Tzevaot, and the vineyard is the house of Israel. And the Ish Yehuda, and the man of Judah, is the Nata Sha'ashuav, the planting of his pleasure, the planting of his delight, Sha'ashua, his pleasure. And then this last phrase again, which really for the third time expresses the same thought that's been expressed earlier, but now in different language, a really strong play on words at the end here. And he waited, Vaikav, again from Kava in the PL, and he waited for le mishpat, for justice. Vehine, but behold, mispach, but behold, bloodshed, an outpouring of blood. This is perhaps a word that Isaiah is making up here slightly. The root safak, with a samek on the front, means to pour out. But here's a noun form constructed basically on safak, but the samek has been changed to a sin, perhaps to more closely echo and slightly counterfeit and pervert this previous noun, mishpat, justice. Hear the sound play there. He waited for mishpat, but instead, behold, there was mispach. And the last phrase, litzdaka, for righteousness. Again, it's what he's waiting for. He waited for righteousness. Vahine, but behold, tzaaka, a cry of distress, an outcry. He waited for tzedaka, but instead found tzaaka. What to do when preaching this passage? I think it's important to acknowledge that there is not much gospel in this passage. Perhaps the only statement of gospel in the whole piece, besides all of the evident care that God extends to the vineyard at the beginning, however, that same care comes back to condemn them in the end. What more could he have done? He says, there is the statement at the very end that the vineyard of Yahweh is the house of Israel, and the people of Judah are the planting of his delight, which is a hopeful phrase on its own. However, God has just announced his imminent plan to destroy this vineyard, even though it is his delight. And as chapter 5 continues, well, the very next word in chapter 5 after our pericope is woe. And chapter 5 will repeat this theme of woe several times. God will say in verse 13 that his people will go into exile. He says in verse 14, Jerusalem's splendor will descend into the mouth of Sheol. And so to find gospel for this passage, I think to preach gospel on the basis of this passage, we need to look beyond this passage alone. In Isaiah 6, we find out that there will be a remnant. Even after God's judgment, he will leave a remnant. The holy seed is in the stump. And in Isaiah 11, we'll hear that the shoot from the stem of Jesse will sprout forth, and God will accomplish great things. Justice and righteousness will be a part of the reign of this shoot who comes from the stem of Jesse, the justice and righteousness that weren't found in God's judged vineyard here in this passage. But the most delightful place to look in the book of Isaiah for gospel that relates to Isaiah chapter 5 is in the prophet's explicit words in chapter 27, Isaiah chapter 27, especially beginning in verse 2. He's just talked about the day is going to come when God will slay the dragon with his great and strong sword. And it says in verse 2, in that day, a pleasant vineyard, sing of it. I, the Lord, am its keeper or guardian. Every moment I water it, lest anyone punish it. I keep it night and day. I have no wrath. Would that I had thorns and briars to battle. I would march against them. I would burn them up together, or let them lay hold of my protection. Let them make peace with me. Let them make peace with me. So a lot of the language of verse 5 is used here, but it's completely turned on its head, especially the statement, I have no wrath, God says. And if there's thorns and thistles afflicting the vineyard, no longer is this God's doing. In fact, God is going to march against these thorns and thistles to get rid of them for the sake of the vineyard. And verse 6 especially, 27 verse 6, in days to come Jacob shall take root, Israel shall blossom and put forth shoots and fill the whole world with its fruit. How could it be that this hopeless vineyard, which can bring nothing but sour grapes in spite of all of God's care and provision, how could it be that suddenly God is promising that one day Jacob will take root and fill the whole world with its fruit, and here presumably good fruit? The answer comes in the Son of Jacob, in Jesus Christ, who as true Israel is pleasing before God. He is the planting of God's delight and pleasure. And the fruit that he brings forth finally is the fruit of mishpat and tzedakah, justice and righteousness for all the world that God has desired. John talks of this in John chapter 15. I wish that it were the gospel reading that was sometimes paired with Isaiah 5 here, but John 15, Jesus says that he is the true vine. He is the true vine. Israel was God's vine, his vineyard, but they were not faithful. Jesus now is the faithful, the true vine. And then he goes on to talk about how all who are connected with him, all who are joined to the vine, will bear much fruit. All who are in Christ will bear much fruit. And even now, around us, through the people of God in the world, Jesus Christ is filling the whole world with his good fruit. And the day will come when all creation will be filled with nothing but the fruits of righteousness and justice. And that righteousness and justice will be through us, done by us, but ultimately it will all stem to true Israel, to the true vine, Jesus Christ, who brings hope even in the face of such a dismal picture like Isaiah 5 here in this passage. Or you could say, brings hope into such a dismal picture like the sin that is the wreck and ruin of our own lives apart from him. Well, that's more than enough time on Isaiah 5, so I'll stop there. The Lord bless your preaching on this passage, and may he make this passage an encouragement and a rebuke as well to you personally.